Half Price Horror.
Hello and welcome to Half Price Horror, where we get our terror at a discount and pass the savings on to you. Half Price Horror is a spoiler-heavy podcast that takes a deep dive into scary movies curated by the selection at the local Half Price bookstore. I'm your host, John, and today we'll be taking a look at Zaider, aka Revenge of the Dead, from 1983. Written by Pupi Avati, Maurizio Costanzo, and Antonion Avati, and directed by Pupi Avati. Avati is, of course, an Italian director, and so it's pretty natural to assume that this is part of the fine Italian tradition of racing a film to market to capitalize on the success of an American book or movie. In this case, Stephen King's Pet Sematary, which also features a mysterious hidden location that can revive corpses buried within its boundaries, and protagonists who literally as well as figuratively dig too deeply into its mysteries. Although, folks who saw the lurid American cover for the VHS edition, which featured a zombie bursting through the sidewalk and had the gloriously trashy title Revenge of the Dead, could be forgiven for thinking it was yet another Romero ripoff. But actually, it was neither of those things. Avanti beat King to the punch by several months, even though King's novel was completed earlier. It sat in his file cabinet for several years, as he was convinced no one would want a novel that centered so grimly on the death of a toddler. In fact, the similarities appear for once to be genuine coincidence, as both of them are based on real events in their creators' lives. The idea for King's book began when he narrowly stopped his son from running into the path of a speeding truck, but Avati got the notion for Zaider when he bought a second-hand electric typewriter from a pawn shop and noticed that the old ink ribbon still retained the impression of every keystroke its former owner had made with it. He began imagining some aspiring writer finding a similar typewriter and discovering a deep, dark secret hidden on its ribbon, and combined that with his interest in the 1920s French alchemist known only as Fulcanelli and his book The Mystery of the Cathedrals, which purports to decode hidden symbols in European religious architecture that reveal the secrets to transmutation of base metals into gold or uranium. A feat Fulcanelli supposedly performed in front of witnesses, although, as always, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. If this all sounds familiar, it's because a lot of Fulcanelli's more influential ideas wound up infiltrating popular culture, culminating in the novel and movie The Da Vinci Code, which is not directly based on Fulcanelli's work, but certainly bears its stamp. Avati's take on the whole notion revolved around certain secret sites with alchemical properties, which allowed open defiance of the laws of physics and which were turned into shrines of worship for various faiths over the centuries due to the seeming miracles that could be performed there. This all comes from the Revenge of the Dead DVD, which features a very nice interview with Avati where he talks about his career, his feelings about the similarities to King's work, his impetuous decision to fire his cinematographer with several days of shooting still remaining. It's a great listen from a director who's still working to this day. His most recent film was in 2023. And I'll tell you right now, you're going to want this DVD because this movie is available exactly nowhere on streaming, and even most of the bootlegs uploaded to YouTube are in Italian with no English subtitles. The film stars Gabrielle Lavia as the aspiring author Stefano. He's best known to American audiences for his appearances in Dario Argento's films Inferno and Profondo Rosso, aka Deep Red. He played a character named Carlo in both movies, although I'm pretty sure he wasn't supposed to be the same person. He was also in the movie Beyond the Door, as well as a number of other films that didn't make it over to America, and he's also still working to this day, having appeared in Avati's most recent film, La Quattrodecesima Domenica del Tempo Ordinario, which translates to the 14th Sunday of Ordinary Time, a reference to a particular date on the Catholic calendar that would probably make a lot more sense if I'd seen the movie. Stefano's incredibly patient wife Alessandra is played by Anne Canavas, part of a very long career spent almost entirely in French and Italian cinema, although she did have a part in the 2011 sci-fi thriller Eva, which didn't even get an American release until 2015 through the unfortunate auspices of the Weinstein Company. As with Lavia, she is still working today with a 2023 release on her IMDb page, and anyone who can stay employed as an actor for 40 years is definitely doing something right. pretty much everyone else in the cast is somehow involved in the conspiracy. I'd say spoilers, but that's really kind of how conspiracy thrillers work. There's always the big reveals that the person you trusted is involved in the conspiracy. So we have Cesare Barbetti as Dr. Meyer, the scientist obsessed with solving the mystery of death and willing to kill to do it, which, I mean, if he gets it right, he can always fix them later, can't he? Barbetti did his share of acting prior to his death in 2006, but he's really better known for the staggering 338 credits he had doing voice dubbing for a wide variety of Italian films that included Cinema Paradiso, Demons 2, Phenomena, The Beyond, City of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, where he did some uncredited dubbing for David Emge, and Let Sleeping Corpses Lie, aka The Living Dead at Manchester Morgue. It's a very impressive body of work. His sidekick, the apparent psychic Gabriella, is played by Paola Tanziani, whose resume is almost the opposite. She only had a handful of roles before this, and only one afterward, and has seemingly departed the acting field altogether. Even Google doesn't turn up much about her beyond her appearance in this movie, so unfortunately I can't even tell you that she's the top belly dancing instructor in Hollywood or a member of a bizarre cult or anything. If she's any of those things, she's keeping it well under wraps. Professor Casey, who begins as an ally to Stefano and winds up co-opted into the conspiracy, is played by John Stacey. This was one of his final roles before his death in 1988, but he had a lengthy career in both Italian and British film and television that included The Agony and the Ecstasy, as well as Gidget Goes to Rome. Now that's some range there. The man bankrolling their scheme, credited as Mr. Big on IMDb and The Man from Chartres on Wikipedia, incidentally, it is very hard to track down who played some of the minor roles because the credits don't list names with the parts, and IMDb and Wikipedia are both a little inconsistent, so I did the best I could, but it's a fine needle to thread here. This man is Bob Tonelli. He was in another Avati film, The House with Laughing Windows, but as he passed away in 1987, he didn't really have much time to pick up many roles after this film. The same is true of Ferdinando Orlandi, who played the conspiracy's all-purpose henchman Giovine. He was also in The House with the Laughing Windows and died in 1991. And on that somewhat somber note, let's dig in. The film starts with a lovely goblin-inspired score over the opening credits, heavy on synth and strings and composed by Riz Ortolani, who also did the score for Cannibal Holocaust and literally hundreds of other Italian films. It comes out of it into an old woman approaching an elegant old house at night back in the 1950s, calling out for the inhabitants before she's gruesomely murdered by a figure that rises up from behind her to slash down her throat and across her collarbone. Which feels like such a classically lurid and exploitative opening for an Italian gore picture that I feel like you could be forgiven for imagining that the whole movie is going to be a Fulci-style explosion of random and unexplained murders connected together by a tissue-thin plot. And indeed, most of the complaints I've seen about this movie were that they came expecting exactly that and wound up feeling let down. So let's just get it out of the way now. This is a film that deploys its gore rarely and strategically to intense effect. The next day, a young Dr. Meyer and his cohorts come to the house, cordoning it off in all directions and bringing a young psychic, Gabriella, who's played as a child by Veronica Morricone, to investigate. At least, I assume she's a psychic. It's never openly stated, but the way they treat her as a sort of human Geiger counter entirely against her will seems to pretty persuasively argue that she's got some sort of extrasensory perception. Even though the film came out in 1983, it's got a very 70s feel to it, and one of the biggest ways it feels 70s is the way it treats psychic phenomena as something so common and accepted that it doesn't even need to be explained, and also the way that it involves scientists trying to plumb the mysteries of life after death. We saw this in The Stone Tape, which is a 1972 movie, and it has a lot of the same themes, including, of course, don't dig too deeply, you might not like what you find. As night falls, various bizarre occurrences begin to manifest, and Meyer pretty much just manhandles Gabriella down to the basement and then to the root cellar below the basement to search out the source of the supernatural events. She's uncontrollably drawn to a particular spot on the earthen floor, scraping and scratching at it with an almost animalistic urgency. But when Meyer goes to get assistance to dig up the spot, Gabriella is attacked by a mysterious figure who savages her legs so badly that it has to be amputated. But he doesn't bother following her to the hospital. He's busy disinterring the body, which has been reduced to mere bones with a few personal belongings identifying him as Paolo Zader, and Gabriella's slipper, impossibly interred beneath the undisturbed earth, and clutched in the corpse's bony fingers. And maybe I'm a sucker for the inventively weird, but I really like this unusual take on the zombie. It's clear that Zader isn't literally rising out of his grave to commit these murders. Instead, it seems like while his body is buried in this particular spot, his spirit is allowed to roam free and manifest itself as a physical, tangible entity that can affect the material world. He's almost a kind of thought form, what the spiritualists called a tulpa, even though that's actually an appropriation of a Buddhist concept in a very culturally insensitive way, and I think that's such a cool idea for a killer zombie that I honestly could have watched a whole television series about it. Also, as an aside, I love that the police inspector, who's played by Andrea Mantucci, dramatically dumps out the belongings and says, "Not much to go on," to find out who he was. Shortly before, Meyer examines the items and finds a library card to the Vatican secret archives issued to Paolo Zader. Like, my dude, did you even look at this stuff before handing it over? Meyer recognizes the name Zader and announces that the cellar must be home to a K-Zone. But before we can find out what that is, we cut to the present day and the city of Bologna, where aspiring author Stefano is returning home to his wife for their first anniversary dinner. He's given her a lovely gold bracelet, while she's given him an expensive electric typewriter that she found used in a pawn shop with its cord missing. But she got the cord replaced, and he's absolutely thrilled to get it. It's kind of weird with 40 years of hindsight, but this was an era where a lot of authors argued that they actually preferred working on a typewriter to using a computer. This is obviously faded as the advantages of being able to edit documents better and email manuscripts directly to the publisher in print-ready format became clear, but 1983 would have very much been a time when people still romanticized the tangible feeling of striking a key and hearing that distinctive smack of the bar hitting the paper. After the two of them enjoy a romantic interlude, and another way this film differentiates itself from its more exploitative Italian counterparts, there's no nudity, Stefano decides to go down and try out his new toy. He begins to type in a very hunt-and-peck style that's almost physically painful for me to look at after a lifetime of writing on computers, but the ink ribbon soon runs out and he opens up the machine to take a look at it. He's fascinated to realize that the impressions of every keystroke remain on the old ribbon, and discovers that whoever owned the typewriter before him had written a letter to someone announcing that they'd discovered an unclaimed K-Zone and planned to use it to shatter the barrier of death once and for all. Incidentally, as weird and unexplained as the term K-Zone is, I kind of love it because it does have the authentic feel of that old Charles Fort era where everyone was giving all of their pseudoscience extremely scientific-sounding terms, things like N-rays and orgones, and all of this bizarre and inexplicable jargon that you had to pick up in order to even debunk some of this stuff. K-Zone feels very authentic to the era in which it was coined. That's cool. Now, obviously, the contents of the ribbon are a pretty interesting little tidbit for an aspiring writer to build off of. And once he replaces the ribbon, Stefano decides to retype the old letters in their entirety. Once he gets them written out, he goes to visit his former instructor, Professor Casey, at the university where he teaches to see if he knows anything about what a K-Zone is and what it might do. Casey's quick to mention that Stefano's dropped out of college and his two previous novels haven't sold, something he apparently learned from Alessandra, who's still in school, and something that honestly raises a lot of questions about how the couple are able to support themselves, given that we never see either one of them working at a job of any kind. But maybe this can just be chalked up to the superior social safety net of European countries, and it only seems weird to us because we've become accustomed to living in a dystopian hellscape where your life depends on constant productivity. Casey and Stefano talk in Casey's office, and speaking of doing things differently in Europe, there's a 19-year-old student waiting there that Casey ushers out and casually mentions that she's into older men. Stefano shows the letters to Casey, who does in fact recognize the term K-zone. It was coined by a researcher in alchemy named Paolo Zeder, who theorized that certain sites that were used to make contacts with the metaphysical realms, such as Delphi, where the oracles made prophecies for the ancient Greeks, had geological properties that rendered them exempt from the standard flow of time as we understand it. Zeder claimed that death did not exist in these K-zones, which explains why the unnamed writer of the letter believed that he could donate his own body to the experimental work being done and escape the oncoming end of his earthly existence. Of course, Casey's actual notes on this have vanished. Not that there's anything suspicious about that or anything. After the meeting, Stefano meets up with his police officer friend Guido, played by Alex Partexano, asking him for help in tracing the owner of the typewriter. He then goes home, where the student from Casey's office sexually assaults him and screams homophobic insults at him when he manages to fend off her advances. This is probably the strangest element of the movie, and the one I genuinely can't fit into the puzzle surrounding it. She doesn't seem to have anything to do with anything. And I don't really get why we needed to devote any screen time to her part of the story, but it's possible that she's got a connection that's only implied and I missed it. Certainly it's suspicious in hindsight that she was alone in Casey's office and all of his notes related to K-zones went missing. We then get a brief interlude where we see that Gabriella, now a grown woman who walks stiffly due to her prosthetic leg, is continuing to pursue Zader's research in the same secret Vatican archives he belonged to, before cutting back to Stefano, Alessandra, and Guido together in Stefano's apartment. Guido's managed to find the address for the previous owner of the typewriter, and Alessandra gives him a gift that's a little pin with an engraving of a gun and handcuffs on it that surely won't turn up as evidence later down the road. And I will admit, I wonder about this plot point because it seems very likely based on what we see later that Guido is a member of the conspiracy, and surely the easiest way to prevent Stefano from getting too close is to simply say that nope, the search for the typewriter's original owner was a bust and this is all just a weird dead end. But then again, Casey later turns out to be a member of the conspiracy as well, sorry, spoilers, so I think we can make a pretty safe assumption that the people behind all this are willing to co-opt people as well as threaten or kill them. And that's honestly one of the things I love most about Zeder. The conspiracy isn't opaque and all-encompassing the way it is in a lot of these kinds of movies. You really get a lot of information about it right from the beginning, and you actually see the people working behind the scenes on it and learn about their motivations and capabilities. So often these things are presented as a mystery with the constant paranoia used to paper over any number of plot holes, because the villains are always in control and constantly maneuvering the hero in accordance with their nebulous and ever-shifting goals. But here you can pretty much follow the whole thing back to front as well as front to back with only a few bits of shaky logic here and there, like Casey and Guido helping Stefano at certain points when, if they were members of the conspiracy all along, they could have just dead-ended his inquiries. That's such a cool way of presenting it, more like a chess match than a game of blind man's buff, and I wish we saw it more often. Stefano goes to visit the typewriter's original owner, Don Luigi Costa, and finds a burly man in a tracksuit, Giovine, although his name is never given in the American translation at least, tossing the priest's office. Being a naturally trusting type, Stefano shows the man the letters believing him to be Costa, and the man simply insults him and kicks him out. I also love that Stefano is actually really bad, not just at investigating this conspiracy, but in actually thinking of it as a conspiracy at all. To him, this is an interesting intellectual puzzle, grist for his next novel, and not at all something to genuinely believe in until right near the very end of the film. It's a very nice twist on the usual immediate paranoia that grips protagonists in this kind of story, even if it does sometimes make him seem a little bit dense. Later, Stefano and Guido go swimming together, presumably in the apartment complex's pool, and it's safe to say that Guido's acting very sketchy. He disappears during an otherwise unexplained power outage, and when he does turn up, Stefano discovers that the letters and the typewriter ribbon have both vanished in his absence. But Guido swears that he didn't take them, so Stefano retraces his steps back to the last place he saw them, Don Luigi's office. But the priest isn't there, and the two other priests, Don Mario and Don Emilio, played by Aldo Sassi and Adolfo Biletti, respectively, tell him that Don Luigi renounced his vows 10 years ago and disappeared. When Stefano insists that he visited the man in his office, the two priests go to take a look and find that the whole place has been ransacked. My best guess, based on what we see elsewhere in the movie, is that it's Guido's inquiries that prompt this sudden flurry of activity. When he tried to find out who owned the typewriter and came up with the name Don Luigi Costa, that brought him to the attention of Meyer and his fellow researchers, and they both blackmailed him into keeping tabs on Stefano and sent their thug Giovine to go through Costa's papers and make sure there was nothing left that could trace the priest back to them. Don Mario explains that he knows nothing about any letters Don Luigi might have written, but he does know that the priest abandoned his vows after discovering he had incurable cancer. He went off to live with his sister, and naturally that becomes Stefano's next clue. Gabriella, meanwhile, has gone to Chartres to rendezvous with Dr. Meyer in a scene that's scored with much more drama than the situation demands. This is a very bombastic score. Good, but bombastic. And she hands over to him the typewriter ribbon and the two letters. They meet with their backer, who's skeptical even after all these years of research that they might truly be on the verge of discovering life after death. But Meyer saw Zader existing beyond death, and he refuses to be stopped now when they're finally so close to uncovering the truth beyond the veil. Stefano gets a call from an anonymous source, offering to meet him at 10 to provide more details on the K-Zones, which is always such a time-honored trope of the genre that I can't really be too mad at it, even though it's kind of out of place here. The caller turns out to be the same student who sexually assaulted him earlier, and of course she's killed by Giovine before she can meet with him because that too is a time-honored trope of the genre. With only one piece of evidence remaining to him, Stefano and Alessandra go to visit Don Luigi's sister, although Alessandra decides she's getting a little sick of all these mysteries and instead takes a little self-care time at the beach. Stefano invents a story about being one of the kids Don Luigi used to take to summer camp in Spine back when he was still a priest, and discovers that Costa died approximately a month ago, which explains why a lot of this stuff is only just now kicking off. His sister, who turns out to be blind, offers to show him up to the old man's room, which is now for rent, and Stefano goes in only to discover that it too has been tossed. And whoever searched it left behind a little silver pin with a gun and handcuffs. Stefano decides to call Guido and find out what he's been up to recently, but the police station says that he's been transferred and won't give out any further information. It seems like the whole thing is a dead end, but just as they're about to give up and go back to Bologna, Stefano spots Giovine walking Don Luigi's sister out to his car. He tails them to a cemetery and cajoles Alessandra into doing a little spying on his behalf, since she won't be recognized. It turns out Giovine's just bringing her to visit her brother's grave, which is awfully nice for the professional murder henchman, but because she's blind, he apparently has no problem bringing her to the wrong spot and letting her think it belongs to her brother. You'd think she'd be able to trace the engravings on the headstone, but I guess she just takes his word for it. Or maybe she knows, and she also knows that Giovine is a murder henchman. I mean, it's not like you're going to complain real loudly around him. Realizing that they've concealed Don Luigi's actual resting place, Stefano and Alessandra visit the hospital where he was treated for his cancer. By a happy coincidence, the chief administrator there is a friend of Alessandra's father, and she tries to use their connection to get him to reveal where the old priest was buried. But it's not until Stefano threatens to get the police involved that Dr. Melis, played by Marcello Tusco, gives up the location. Which is obviously suspicious, although I'll admit that I did think the character's bandaged hand was worked into the script as an explanation for an onset injury and not a setup for a big reveal later on. Stefano and Alessandra go to the private cemetery in Spine, where they do in fact find Don Luigi's tomb in an underground crypt. But the headstone is cracked, and when Stefano pushes a wire through the wet cement used to repair the break, he finds that there's nothing behind it. He takes the small framed photo off the headstone and leaves, certain now that Costa's body was disinterred as the letter described, but with nothing further to go on to suggest its true location. There's an odd little fake-out scare here where somebody momentarily closes the crypt on him, but it comes to nothing. I suppose they felt like they needed to have a jump scare somewhere around here? Anyway, elsewhere, we see Don Luigi's body lowered into a metal casket, which is soldered shut with a hole on one end for a video camera to seat into. Dr. Meyer and his team rig the entire area with cameras and special lighting, as well as temperature sensors to test the measurable heat levels within the casket. and they hand their findings over to a man with a bandaged hand. Insert musical sting here. The couple begin to head back to Bologna, with Alessandra very happy to leave the whole mystery behind them. But on the drive back, Stefano remembers that the old camp Don Luigi used to take children to, and whose photographs were on the wall of both the church and his sister's house, is right nearby and adjacent to some old Hellenic ruins. Remembering what Professor Casey told him about K-Zone sitting on sites where people made contact with the metaphysical, Stefano puts two and two together and realizes that Don Luigi must have found the K-Zone at the campsite. The site they used for filming is the Colonia Varese Hotel, built as a holiday camp for Italian fascists in 1938 and abandoned since the end of World War II. Surprisingly, it's never actually been demolished and still exists in some form to the present day, and it's wonderfully atmospheric for the third act. There's a small gas station slash motel across the road from the abandoned camp, run by a man named Mirko, played by Ennio Ferrario. And Stefano decides to take a room there despite his wife's strenuous objections. She leaves without him, frustrated, and he decides to chat with Mirko's friend Benny about the work going on at the old campsite, which is supposedly under construction to build a new hotel, even though the area is completely deserted. It's pretty clear Benny doesn't have a lot of people to talk to because he immediately spills the beans about everything that went on there, including a nudist colony that was established for a while but that broke up after their dog died and was buried, leading to a number of bizarre and inexplicable animal attacks until the beast was finally disinterred. Again, let me stress, it's genuinely not possible for this to be ripping off Pet Sematary unless Avadi got a copy of King's unpublished manuscript. Examining the grounds near sunset, Stefano hears strange noises just before he runs into Don Mario, who's out there foraging for blackberries to bring home to Don Emidio. The priest warns Stefano away, only to wind up himself attacked and killed by a figure he recognizes in the last moments of his life. When Stefano returns to his hotel room, he's greeted by a returning Alessandra, who's grown concerned for his safety following a meeting with Professor Casey. He's apparently warned them to drop the whole thing, a warning that's only reinforced by a newspaper headline announcing the death of Guido in a tragic accident. Presumably, he was beginning to have second thoughts about his involvement in the whole deal, possibly related to the death of the student earlier because there was a second killer whose face we never see. Stefano almost takes her up on the warning, but then he finds Don Luigi's missing typewriter cord in his hotel room and realizes the old priest must have stayed there prior to his death, and that the cleaning staff is terrible at their job. I try to get a discount at the very least. Mirko explains that his family just took over the hotel, so he doesn't know anything about an ex-priest staying there. But he has been keeping an eye on the camp across the street with a telescope, so he knows that whoever lives there has imported a number of lights and television cameras. I kind of feel like not taking care of this was maybe a weak point in the conspiracy's efforts, as was not bricking up the secret entrance the locals used to use to get into the place back during the war, but you can't think of everything. I mean, what do I know, right? I'm not raising the dead. Stefano goes inside the building and finds the room full of monitoring equipment, complete with live closed-circuit television footage of Don Luigi's eyelids moving a full month after his death. He uses the attached VCR to make a recording of what he sees, and gives the tape to Alessandra, telling her to give it to Professor Casey, which she does try to do. But her car won't start, and when Mirko drops her off at the train station, the train is suspiciously empty. And she's soon approached by the stalking figure of Giovine going through cabin after cabin to get to her in a wonderfully tense, if brief, chase. She flees through the now moving train, only to bump directly into Dr. Mellis as the action cuts away. It's clear that things don't look good for her, though. And that night, as Stefano watches through Mirko's telescope, he sees Don Luigi wandering through the ruins of the old camp, his face deathly pale, but clearly alert and aware. He talks to Professor Casey, who claims the tape is blank, but of course he's been suborned into the conspiracy now and reluctantly acknowledges to Dr. Mellis that Stefano is just one more loose end to be tied up now. As soon as Stefano hangs up the phone, Benny shows up, taking him to the dead body of Don Mario, who has a similar vicious slash to the old woman from the beginning of the film, to demonstrate to him that if Don Luigi isn't disinterred, he'll continue to kill anyone who lives in the area, and that includes Benny. The two of them go through the secret entrance again, but the sound of a scream spurs Stefano to go on ahead, and behind him, hands reach directly through the crumbling brick to strangle Benny to death in a fantastic scare. Stefano finds the source of the screams pretty quickly. It's Giovine, whose head is now a good 3 feet away from the rest of him, and Gabriella, who's now missing an arm to go with her amputated leg. She dies right in front of Stefano, warning him with her final words to unbury the corpse of Don Luigi, and Stefano sees on the closed-circuit cameras as the old man opens his eyes and cackles wildly from his toothless mouth in a shot that wound up on the poster and haunted me back when I first saw it in Jamie Russell's encyclopedic book on zombie movies, Book of the Dead. He only devotes 3 pages to it, but it intrigued me so much I've been looking for this movie ever since. Panicked, Stefano flees the site with Don Luigi's thought form stalking along behind him, and returns to the hotel only to find Alessandra's dead body lying on their bed. Meanwhile, Dr. Meyer, Dr. Mellis, and Professor Casey are reporting on their findings, spinning them in a pretty positive light, all things considered, and accidentally creating something of a plot hole when Casey says he's been involved in this for years. Which, why would he tell Stefano about K-Zones if he's part of this conspiracy? Then again, he might be lying to save his own skin. I am very reluctantly and recently involved in all this and would just as soon not have gotten entangled in any of it probably isn't what you want to say to the orchestrator of the entire conspiracy. Stefano, meanwhile, responds to the death of his wife exactly as you might imagine you would if you had access to your very own resurrection hole, and like Lewis Creed, he makes the mistake of imagining that it'll be different with his wife than it was with all the other people who were buried there and came back homicidal. He drags Alessandra to the K-Zone and inters her corpse there, and waits for night to fall with the lost and desperate expression of a man who's on his final thread of sanity. And as you can probably guess, when she comes to him with her skin deathly pale and embraces him, we hear a final scream as he learns that there are some lines we were never meant to cross. It's a really beautiful final shot, haunting and terrifying, and I love that we don't get the gore you might expect from another Italian movie in this vein. We don't need it. The anguished, agonized look on his face as her embrace tightens says more than blood ever could, and all I can really say is that I wish there'd been a sequel because I honestly could have spent another 10 hours with this world and its secrets. And will I hang on to this movie? I absolutely will. It's a very different kind of movie from things like Nightmare City or The Beyond, restrained and taut and fascinating in the way it leads from one clue to the next, but I think it's really unusual and clever, and I wish more people knew about it because it deserves to be more popular than it is. I hope everyone listening goes out and finds it, either on DVD or as a bootleg on YouTube. It's unfortunately not available for streaming legitimately right now, as I mentioned earlier. And I would love to sit down and chat with anyone who appreciates it like me. And if you want to talk about conspiracy thrillers, the cultural appropriation of tulpas, or about anything else that came up on this podcast, you can find me on Twitter as @halfhorror, and on Tumblr, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd as Half Price Horror. My watch list on Letterboxd contains everything I plan to tackle in future episodes. If there's something you'd like to hear about, let me know. You can also support the show at patreon.com/halfpricehorror, and you can rate and review me on Apple Podcasts and anywhere else this podcast is found. And next time on Half Price Horror, well, we finally come to the end of our journeys with Freddy Krueger, as we watch Freddy's Dead, The Final Nightmare. It's kind of a shame they never did anything else with the character after 1991, and I can only assume this box set has a making-of featurette, because there's still another disc in here and we know that— oh, son of a bitch, not again.